From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For millions of years, the continents on Earth developed separately. They had different plants and different animals. They had different germs, different cultures. And then came the voyage of Christopher Columbus, and everything changed. In his book, 1493, the journalist Charles Mann says what happened after Columbus was the forming of a single new world from the collision of others. People and creatures started to mix and mingle. Mann says it's the reason there are tomatoes in Italy and oranges in Florida. It's part of the reason for slavery and the potato famine. Suffice it to say, Columbus didn't discover a new world as much as create a new one. Today in the program, Charles Mann is joining us to talk about this new world and the birth of globalization. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In some ways, Charles Mann's book, 1493, is about action and effect, how one seemingly insignificant moment can ripple its way through societies and ecosystems and transform people and places. Mann explores how Christopher Columbus's voyage across the Atlantic really changed everything. Plants and animals and germs and cultures that were once isolated started to migrate and mix. Mann calls it an ecological convulsion, the most momentous biological event since the death of the dinosaurs. And it set off this exchange that has given us tomatoes in Italy and chili peppers in Thailand. It fostered the rise of Europe. It devastated imperial China. It brought new technology and innovation, but it also brought disease and famine that killed off millions. Charles Mann is a correspondent for The Atlantic, Science, and Wired. He's the author of 1491, which explores the Americas before Columbus's arrival. His latest, as I said, is 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. And Charles Mann, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I want to start with this experience that I read about that you had. This was in Mexico, and this was, I think it was 1983. Because I think in some ways this sort of gave me some insights about the themes that you explore. Talk about that, if you would, because that, as I understand it, you started thinking differently about the world after that experience.
Yeah, I was, as I said, a correspondent for Science. And at that time, there was a lot of concern about problems with the ozone layer that were caused by these chemicals that were in spray cans.
Yeah.
And NASA had a mission where they were going up into the upper atmosphere and sampling the conditions there. And they were going from way up north to way south, you know, in a kind of series of hops. And they invited me to come along. And I thought, this sounds great. Of course I'd like to go. And we landed in Yucatan, in the Yucatan Peninsula, and in Mexico. And for some reason, the equipment wasn't working. So we had a day there. And we rented a car and went to see the Maya ruins. Yeah. And I was just astonished about what I saw in Chichen Itza and Uxmal and so forth. I'd lived in Italy for a couple of years, and so I was kind of familiar with Greek and Roman ruins.
Yeah.
And these were much, much larger, and to my at least unsophisticated eye, equally sophisticated and, you know, important. And I thought, this is amazing. You know, in school we learned about Greece and Rome, as we should.
Yeah.
But I don't think the word Maya was mentioned in my high school. And this is our own hemisphere.
Yeah.
And I was completely flabbergasted that there has been this huge society there that I knew absolutely nothing about that was, you know, so close to us. And so on my own, I went back four or five times. And it happened that just at that time was this incredible intellectual feat going on where they were deciphering the Maya written language, or a group of scholars were doing this. And there was this explosion of knowledge going that was telling us so much about these rather amazing people. And I discovered, as I talked to the archaeologists, that similar explosions of knowledge were about peoples in the Americas were happening in South America, in North America, in Central America, and that if you added them all up together, they were giving us a completely different picture of what life had been like over here.
So what was the picture? Because it seems like – because this is one of the kind of misimpressions that, that you're working to dispel. The idea is that these people were these kind of noble creatures who were letting nature act upon them, that they weren't land managers, that they were – I mean that's the impression, right?
They were kind of patsies.
Patsies, right.
Well, you know, the way in – it happened that about that time my mother demanded that I go back to my childhood home and bring out all the stuff that I'd left there since going to college. Huh. And I was embarrassed to discover my eighth grade American history textbook from Highland Junior High School. And I looked in it, and I realized what I've been taught was basically three things about the first sort of 15, 20,000 years of American history, that Indians walked across the Bering Straits 12,000 years ago. They lived in these sort of small, for the most part, small scattered bands, and they had so little impact on the environment that for all intents and purposes, the Americas were a wilderness.
Yeah.
And what these archaeologists and anthropologists and geographers and ecologists were telling me, that the last 30 or 40 years of research had taught them that all of these were wrong. They're here for much longer than previously believed. They're here in much greater numbers than previously believed, and they had much greater impact on the environment than previously believed. And in a sense, I thought somebody should write a book.
Yeah. So they were pretty great land managers. They were pretty good at it.
Pretty ambitious. I mean, you know, they're people. They make mistakes.
Yeah.
But these guys are pretty good at it by and large. And and many of the environmental problems we have now with land management stems, in large part from our ignorance about what the landscape had been like before. Mm. And we have this idea of wilderness. And when you think about it, wilderness means that all these people who had lived here for thousands of years, unlike people anywhere else on the planet, had touched nothing. You know, yeah. They're these perfect Sierra Club tourists for thousands of years. And, and in fact, they're people, right? Yeah. And what people do is we like to, you know, fuss around and mess with stuff and create gardens and terraces and do all the things that people like to do. And they had done this for thousands of years. And kind of pretending that there was no impact meant that we've been managing these landscapes all over the West as if they were, you know, quote, wilderness when they weren't.
Yeah. Where does it come from, do you think? Is it this idea, this, you know, this kind of noble savage idea? Where do you think you have any insight on where it comes from?
Well, you know, idea? I mean, you know, it's a little bit telepathy to try and imagine where these ideas come from. But something that's really striking to me is that we now know that Native people, as we say, manage the landscape. One of their principal tools was fire. And so huge areas of the West and the grasslands in particular were burned, but also even on the East Coast. And then there's lots and lots of areas that were cleared for agriculture. When Europeans came, they brought along with them inadvertently European diseases, smallpox, influenza, measles, what have you. And so one of the first results of Europeans coming was this catastrophic decline of Native people, where somewhere in the first 150 or so years after Columbus, somewhere between 2/3 and 90% of all the people in the Americas died. That's the worst demographic catastrophe in human history. I mean, it's just an awful thing. And one of the things that happened was that these landscapes then dramatically changed because the people who had been managing them for, you know, countless centuries suddenly weren't there. There was nobody driving the wheel.
So now they did become wilderness.
In a weird way, wilderness was created. They're feral, I guess would be the way. Right.
Yeah.
Wilderness was created by Europeans. We sort of think that Europeans destroyed it. In fact, they sort of bloodily, in this awful way, created it. And these open areas filled in.
Yeah.
And so when my ancestors came in the 17th century, they looked around and saw all these forests and they thought, it had always been that way.
Oh, now, there's always been pine trees here.
There's always been pine trees here. Yeah. There's always been oak trees here, or what have you. And that was just simply not the case.
Do you think you have we'll get into this as we go, but do you think you have an image of, and does it really make, does it do much good to sort of envision what this land did look like in its natural state? Is there even such a thing? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you'd have to go back, you know, 15, 20,000 years.
Sure.
And there's an ice age that, you know, intervenes in the middle of that. And so, you know, it's sort of fun to imagine. But, you know, at the time, you know, we now know that people were here for much longer than we thought, you know, 20,000 years, 25,000. We just don't really know.
Sure.
And
more than we thought, right?
And many more. And so, you know, at the time, before people were here, there were things like mammoths. You know, these giant mammals were all over the place. And so the conditions have changed so profoundly since then that, you know, thinking about it is fun to know about, but sure, I don't think it has much practical application today. And it certainly shouldn't be the basis for our laws. And, you know, most of the environmental laws we have are based on this premise, implicitly or explicitly, that 1492 is a baseline. They were trying to return things to 1492 conditions, and that condition is no human impact.
Yeah.
And
it's just not true.
It's just not true, and it's led to an awful lot of problems.
You, as I understand it, you had an interest in the work and the art of indigenous people really from when you were quite young. I mean, yeah. As I understand it, your family ended up in Seattle in the Pacific Northwest area, and you really took to it.
Well, I don't know if you've ever been to the Pacific Northwest, but the art of the peoples in there is just really beautiful to me. And it's also, we now know there's a really sort of complicated aesthetic that's associated with it. You know, and if you remember your college, you may have taken an art history course, and they talk about how in Greek art it's based on these certain proportions, like the golden rectangle all that sort of stuff. And Pacific Northwest Coast art is similarly based on certain kinds of ideal shapes, kind of a clamshell shape. And there's really rigid and interesting rules to the way that it was done, kind of like the way when you write a sonnet, there's rigid and interesting rules to the way that it was done. And as a kid, I was completely sort of fascinated by that. And, you know, it's like decoding it in a way that I could see that there was like a plan. And so I liked it. So it wasn't strange to me, the idea that there was, you know, people doing interesting things here. What was shocking to me was that I hadn't realized how large scale it was and that it was all over the Americas.
Yeah. And that the way you mentioned Highland Junior High.
Yeah.
So the books that you were experiencing, I'm guessing your kids, what they were being taught wasn't that much different.
Yeah. And another impetus for writing this is that my oldest son went to school and I was looking at his history textbooks and, you know, it was the same stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of amazing to me because it was outdated when I learned it, but it was really outdated when he was learning it.
I'm not sure if you actually Alfred Crosby.
Yeah, wonderful guy.
Wonderful, and I guess you had a conversation with him.
I actually got to know him a little bit.
Did you?
Yeah.
And he wrote this book, a really influential book called Ecological Imperialism, which raises some of these questions too. But I guess you approached him and said, you know, it's time to kind of update this story.
Well, sure, absolutely. I got to know Al a little bit. He wrote two books, Ecological Imperialism, great book, still in print. Urge your readers, your listeners to buy it. And another book called The Columbian Exchange.
Yeah.
And he is a guy who really, in a sense, put environmental history on the map, the idea that these landscapes that we're looking at, like, you know, outside your window, aren't these timeless things but have been affected by human beings and in turn affected human beings for centuries upon centuries. And they're just beautifully written, wonderful books. And they had an enormous impact and stimulated huge amounts of research.
Yeah.
And so as I got to know Al, I would say to him periodically, Al, look, you know, look at all the stuff you've stimulated. You should really do, you know, the version. And but he's this very restless, creative guy, and he's off to new things. And you go, no. And finally, I was visiting him one day for lunch, and I said, Al, you know, I made my little spiel. And he finally said, sort of tired of it, look, you think it's such a great idea, you do it.
Right.
And so I took his offhand quip, you know, his license, and charged ahead.
So I wanted to have you lay out the kind of basic framework, get us started thinking about this. So and in many ways, I guess it starts 200 million years ago when the world was this single giant landmass.
Pangaea, scientists call it. And geological forces broke it up and forever separating the continents and, you know, completely separating the eastern and the western hemisphere. And along with the geological separation was an ecological or biological separation. As all the ecosystems, you know, over here had no communication with the ecosystems over there for tens of millions of years.
Right.
And what Columbus – and this is Al's great insight – what Columbus did was, in effect, begin the process of reuniting Pangaea, because all these busy ships crossing the Atlantic and the Pacific didn't just carry people. They carried countless other organisms, and huge numbers of creatures from over there came over here, and huge numbers of creatures from over here went over there. And it was this tremendous ecological convulsion as these long separated systems bashed into each other. And it had an enormous impact not only ecologically but also on human history as well. And so 1493, this book that I wrote, is really about trying to trace some of these consequences and to say this is how this ecological explosion filtered into every aspect of our daily lives.
When we get back from a break, we'll sort of work through some of these.
Mm-hmm.
But let me ask you this before we get there, because in some ways the book is really about the beginning of globalization.
Yes.
And there are these two sides to it, of course, which you mentioned in the book. You know, there's the side of economists and entrepreneurs who say, hey, globalization has made societies better and, you know, it's been better for the world. And then you have, you know, cultural nationalists and environmentalists, among others, who say, no, it's been devastating to local communities and to the environment. And you say in the book that you learned that both sides might be right.
Right. They don't contradict each other.
Yeah.
And so simultaneously, you know, oh, for example, my daughter a couple years ago was very, very sick. And she had a bacterial infection in her bones and was saved by intensive antibiotics. That antibiotic was found by some pharmaceutical company in Japan. Yeah. And so my daughter's life is owed to globalization. I mean, it's like a very concrete way of talking about how these trade in exotic organisms, you know, can benefit people. But at the same time, you know, what are they saying? That a quarter of the world's languages are disappearing.
Yeah.
And, you know, each language is a whole way of thinking, is a whole literature, is a whole way of life. And so you have, on the one hand, enormous benefits, and on the other hand, enormous costs, and they're occurring at the same time.
Yeah. It's interesting because your book doesn't really give comfort to either side in some ways. You know what
right.
I mean? But then at the same way, it does. I mean, it's pretty balanced in that way.
Well, I'd like to think so. I mean, you know, ultimately, I think that the question of whether things are, you know, the good part is better than the bad part, that's a question of values.
Yeah.
You know, it's a question of what do you think is important. And that's a question that, you know, I'm not like an expert in that. Every person has to decide what their own values are. I can, I think, tell you what the consequences are, but it's up to the reader to weigh them.
Charles C. Mann is with us. His book is called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Charles Mann is joining us to talk about the new world Columbus created, not discovered, created. It's an important distinction. Mann has written a book that explores how Columbus's voyage across the Atlantic changed everything. The explorer set off an exchange that has given us tomatoes in Italy and chili peppers in Thailand and, well, all kinds of things, and we're talking about it today. The book is called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. So, I guess if there's a theme in this story, it's that all of this change, or a lot of this, worked out reasonably well for Europeans, not so well for native people. Is that fair to say?
I think it's very fair to say. I mean, you know, almost randomly, if you have these kind of convulsive changes, some people are going to be better off than others.
Yeah.
And Europe was the big winner, and I think native peoples in the Americas were the big losers. But it was largely because of germs. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that the way that native people were treated by Europeans is like a tremendous bright spot in human history.
Sure.
But the overwhelming majority of the damage was done by the accidental importation of these diseases. And so, you know, smallpox, influenza, measles, hepatitis, you just name it. A whole cavalcade of these things came over, malaria, yellow fever. And the result was that it's as if all the suffering and death that these diseases had created over the past however many thousands of years in Europe and Asia and Africa were compressed into about 150 years in the Americas.
And the reason – I mean, the thing you've talked about is one of the reasons why the native people weren't used to these kinds of diseases was because of domestic animals.
Yes.
But they did interact with animals, did they not?
Right.
I mean,
but they weren't – yeah. By a quirk of history, there were no – cattle here. There are no horses. There are no, you know, at the time of Columbus, say,
right.
There are no sheep, no goats, no poultry, none of the familiar domestic animals that we know, nor were there any other analogs. There wasn't like some kind of special American cow, you know.
Right.
And the only places that the only real domestic animals there were there up in the Andes. They had, you know, alpacas and llamas and, yeah. and so forth. There was a domesticated honeybee in Mexico. Yeah. There was dogs, of course, and really there just wasn't much else. And the reason this is important is that every now and then, as we now know from things like bird flu, an animal disease, as they say, jumps the species barrier and becomes a human disease.
Right.
And so most of the great killers in human history come from that. Smallpox was originally either camel pox or horse pox. There's a bit of argument about it, but it was definitely from a domesticated animal originally. Flu, of course, came from poultry.
Yeah.
Measles came from bovine rinderpest, and rabies came from bats, and on and on and on. And so native people, so Europeans and Asians and Africans lived in their barns, essentially. You
yeah.
know, if you were a farmer there, you were there with your animals 24/7.
Right.
And, you know, people in the Americas just didn't live with any kind of animals that way at all, except for dogs. And dogs have been with us for so long that by now we've gotten all the disease they're going to give us.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I read something that Crosby said. I think you probably mentioned it, that if Genghis Khan had arrived after the Black Plague, that we wouldn't be speaking a European language.
Right. And that's kind of what happened to the Americas is, so to speak, the Black Plague came in the form of all these diseases. And then right with the Black Plague came Genghis Khan, you know, came a bunch of people who were anxious to move in.
Yeah.
And I would argue, I think with an increasing number of historians and archaeologists and anthropologists and so forth, that this goes a long way towards explaining why small groups of, you know, poorly equipped Europeans at the end of very long supply chains were able to survive and even thrive in landscapes that were completely different from what they had known in the past. You know, absent these diseases, it's very difficult to imagine that my ancestors would have made it here.
Yeah. So the prospect, the potential for native people establishing, you know, military resistance to these other people or political power was really diminished by the fact that they were dealing with just to so much disease
right.
and being wiped out,
well, just
essentially.
Think of it, you know, imagine, Salt Lake City, and suddenly smallpox, you know, untreated kills about 40% of the people that it who contract it. Mm. Measles kills about 9%. Influenza kills, you know, again, completely untreated because these people didn't know what the diseases were, kills about 5%. And these things hit native people in the course of a couple decades. And there's just no society that could stand up to an external invasion when losing two-thirds of its population. There's even kind of a demonstration of this when Hernan Cortez invades Mexico, you know, for the Aztec Empire. It's not generally known, but the Aztecs were not nice people to be under, and they had a lot of people who hated them.
Yeah.
And so he was able to kind of foment a civil war.
Yeah.
And so he marched actually – you know, right at the head of an army of tens of thousands of native people who are really anxious to kick out the Aztecs. And the Aztecs were formidable guys. And they managed to seize, you know, in this famous incident, they managed to seize the king,
yeah.
so to speak. And then there was a big fight and the Spaniards lost. The Aztecs won. They killed two-thirds of the Spaniards. They killed all the horses. And there's this thing called the Noche Triste in Spanish where Cortez supposedly sat down and cried at the ruin of his hopes. But because he was this very indomitable guy, he decided to do it all, try it again. And the second time, accidentally, smallpox came and wiped out 30-40% of the people in the Aztec Empire. Mm. And the second assault won. And so, you know, there's like a natural experiment. First time – no disease, they lose.
Yeah.
Second time, with disease, they win.
And I guess it doesn't do any good to imagine what modern civilization would have been like if with the influence of a more powerful cultural influence of those indigenous people. But do you imagine it from time to time?
I do. I mean, this seems like a great science fiction book, doesn't it?
Does.
Or here's the other one that imagine. If they'd had domestic animals, chances are highly likely that they would have had the same kind of diseases.
Sure.
They're called zoonotic diseases. And so the exchange would have been two-way. right? And because nobody really – they would have said, oh, look at these great animals. They would have brought them over, and Europe and Asia and probably Africa would have been devastated in the same way. So in a certain sense, we're kind of lucky that that didn't occur.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, what would have been like if the population of the Earth in shortly after 1492 had been reduced by two-thirds?
Let me ask you about Jamestown. It's because the first section of the book is about that and this and you describe how its fate was really decided in some ways, or the influence of tobacco was really, really interesting. It was a crazed commodity, I think.
Right. It was the first global commodity fad. Yeah. And if you think about it, tobacco is like this ideal commodity. You can take it. People really like it. It's really fun and it's addictive. Yeah. And I mean, what could be better, right? You know, something that people really can't stop having. And so between about 1580 and about 1615, tobacco explodes across the world. It's the first time that simultaneously people in, you know, Japan and China and India and the Ottoman Empire and Europe are both finding this new thing and saying, boy, I really like this.
Yeah.
And the result is that The English have set up Jamestown largely on two mistaken beliefs. The first is that North America is really, really skinny.
Right.
And they think that they'll be able to like sail up the Chesapeake Bay and go right through to the Pacific and then go to China. And they have this idea because by that point, Sir Francis Drake has actually gone to the west coast of the United States and done this sort of mistaken measurements. And thinks that it's like this isthmus, this tiny little band. So we establish it here and then that's a beachhead for a push to China. And the second is, well, hey, the Spaniards went to Mexico and to Peru and they found all this gold and silver. So we'll go and we'll pay for everything by all this gold and silver that we're going to find in the Chesapeake Bay and, you know, around Maryland.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Maryland is really, really far from the Pacific. And Maryland also has – and Virginia is just not known for its gold and silver. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And so it's a complete disaster.
Yeah.
And so they desperately – and it's very, very expensive for people to send things over. It's like a moonshot. And they keep trying to find things that they can do. That will justify this hideous expense that's been a total financial loss. And, 7 or 8 years in, they hit on tobacco. And there's this problem that tobacco is disapproved of by the English king, who quite rightly thinks this is awful. All these people are smoking this and they're hooked on it and makes people sick and it's sinful, you know. And then the other problem is they've already spent so much money that even though they're making money hand over fist, tobacco, the Virginia Company can't make it. And in the 1620s, it just collapses.
Yeah.
But tobacco goes on and it is the reason that the English are largely in North America.
You know, you were mentioning the landscape that people came to assume was you know, the East Coast landscape, mm-hmm. which was all these pine trees. Now, the effect of that was earthworms.
Right. One of the effects of
one of them, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you think – what we now know, I mean, is that – because of the ice age, you know, giant glaciers squished all the earthworms in northern North America, and then for a couple hundred miles south of it, they were just frozen.
Yeah.
And it turns out that earthworms don't have a lot of get up and go. If you have a little tiny backyard and you put an earthworm in the middle, they're just never going to leave. They just don't move very fast.
Yeah.
And so they hadn't recolonized these areas. And so these ecosystems had evolved that didn't have earthworms cycling the nutrients around. And as you probably learned in school, earthworms are tremendously important to your garden. Well, conversely, if you don't have them, you know, it's also tremendously important. So the English start growing tobacco and the ships start coming in for the tobacco and they have ballast because these tobacco barrels are tremendously heavy. And so you have to balance things out. And the ballast is made out of dirt. They just take dirt, you know, in England and throw it in the bottom of the ships and then dump it out on the shores of the York River or the James River. And that has earthworms in it.
Yeah.
And Europeans start then carrying these earthworms around in this way. And the result is this slow motion ecological transformation as all these species that have evolved in these very different conditions start being wiped out. And in fact, in the far northern reaches of Alberta and Minnesota and even in Massachusetts where I am, there are areas that are still earthworm free where you know, environmental people are trying to fight the earthworms. And they have, you know, there's like the Minnesota Worm Watch. And in my area, there's actually little signs on little ponds where they say, you know, don't dump your worms.
Exactly. These feral species. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was mentioning this idea of the what it would look like. You write about this woman named Melville who says the Mexican landscape is a modern creation.
Yes.
That it used to be much different. And I'm wondering if that – talk about that. And does that give us an insight about what the West looks like now compared to what it could look like?
Right. Well, what she talks about is that they didn't have any grazing animals in the Americas, and certainly not grazing animals in the way that we think of them as, like, you know, fenced in cows and horses and particularly sheep. And Melville wrote a book called A Plague of Sheep. She died a few years ago, poor woman. And in Mexico, they would take these valleys that were actually, we now know, quite verdant and lush because even though they're dry, they had been irrigated and you know, landscape had managed to maximize the trees and, you know, other – and they loosed in sheep. And she has these records of the sheep – you know, this is an area that the sheep had never been. They just went to town. And the numbers of sheep just exploded. It just got rapidly out of control. They just ate everything. And the result of this stripping of these, you know, valleys in central Mexico was the creation of this landscape that you now associate with Mexico, with, you know, these dry, scrubby, you know, Sergio Leone type landscapes. And similarly, these places have been managed by fire, and they didn't manage them in the same way by fire. And they had been these intricate landscapes of terraces and canals and channels and so forth. All that falls to pieces. In our own Southwest, we now know, thanks to the work of geographers like Bill Doolittle at the University of Texas and others, that there's these incredibly complex irrigation networks throughout these areas over at different periods of time. In part of the reason that you know, we're having so much trouble with water management and landscape is that it permanently changed the hydrology of the West, and we until recently didn't know how they had changed it, and so we had sort of mistaken ideas about the history of the landscape itself. And so you add up the fire regime, the water regime, the plant regime, and all of this, and you end up with a situation which we are, you know, managing landscapes with a profound misapprehensions about what they look like in the past, and it's, you know, it's continuously coming up and biting us.
Do you think that as we develop more insights about what it used to look like, what it was, is that going to give us a better way of, you know, grappling with the questions of water and those kinds of things?
I think, in a sense, you're asking now to go into, you know, better is like good and bad, and you know, these are questions of value, really.
Sure.
But in general, you know, how could it be bad to know more about how the place was built up?
Of course.
I mean, in general, but also, and this is personally for me, one of the things that I learned from talking with Native people, from trying to understand, you know, the histories and so forth, is, and this is a gross generalization, but one way to think is that these people didn't think of the environment in a backwards way. Much of the way we think about it is, how can we recapture some ideal past state, you know, a golden age that was in the past?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, a kind of a cultural bias on our parts that's, you know, goes back to being Christians. We're trying to recover Eden. And, you know, it's deep in my heart. I'm a Christian.
Sure.
And so, you know, it's – but when you talk to these people, they tend to be forward. You know, they say not so much how can we get back to the perfect state in the past, but what do we want to build? You know, what kind of place do we want to live in? Let's build it. And I think that kind of approach, which at least to my eye seems – or ear – seems to be often absent from discussion of the environment. It's really all about how terrible we are and how we've sinned. And I'd much rather say, you know, what kind of place do we want to live in? What do we want it to look like? And again, that's personal preference, but it's something I think that at least is, I've learned from, you know, talking to Native people.
Charles C. Mann is with us. His book is called 1493, and covering the new world Columbus created. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Charles Mann. We're talking about his book, 1493, uncovering the new world Columbus created. Let's take a call from Arthur, joining us in Salt Lake City. Arthur, hi.
Hi. I find this one of the most fascinating shows you've ever done, and I'm very impressed with your guest. I would like to know, he keeps referring to the Native American population crash of two-thirds, perhaps as much as 90%. A fellow named Russell Thornton claimed that it was at least 90% and likely 95%. That was in a book he wrote called American Indian Holocaust and Survival, and I'm wondering if your guest is aware of the book and if he thinks that would have made much difference in his conclusions.
Yes, I am aware of the book. It's a terrific book, and Russell Thornton is a great scholar. The great problem with all these numbers is that they're so huge that very small changes in your assumptions leads to enormous changes in the estimate that you get. And so in a sense, I'm waffling. When you say between two-thirds and 90%, it could be 95%. It could be merely 60%. But the point is really there is no society anywhere that can survive unaltered when it loses 60% of the people, when it loses 90%. It almost doesn't make any difference what the final figure is. It's just so large.
Yeah, but the point is that a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And so I guess there's a lot of scholarly argument about the exact number, and I'm trying to avoid the scholarly argument and focus on the big picture, which is that we're dealing with an enormous human loss. And so my hat is off to Russell Thornton. I think that's a great book, but I don't particularly want to endorse any individual number because then you end up arguing about whether it's 90% or 80% or what have you.
Yeah, yeah. Arthur, thanks. Here's an email from Ken who writes from Salt Lake City. He mentions he read your book, 1491, but he also said he read a book, 1421,
yes,
by Gavin Menzies, who claims that the Chinese sailed to the Americas in 1422, left some plants and animals and influenced the native cultures. Ken wants to know what your opinions are about this particular idea and if you've seen any evidence that the Chinese may have influenced American culture.
Well, that book is by 1421 by Gavin Menzies, and he's a retired submarine captain, I believe. He's a British Navy guy. And so I tremendously enjoyed reading the book because it's full of sort of nautical stuff like Patrick O'Brien books. And he's always talking about getting on the poop deck and things like that. I don't really understand what a poop deck is, but I just loved it. I guess the way to put it is he comes and talks about my area, which is I live in New England, and he says that the Chinese established a big colony in Buzzards Bay, which is close to between Rhode Island and in Massachusetts, near Providence and so forth. And the evidence for this is that when Verrazzano, who's the first European who went there in the 1520s, therefore a century later, came there, that he found a special building that was oriented north, east, south, west, with each walls like that. Mm. And that also all the women in that area were much better looking than the women in other parts of New England where he went. And QED, therefore, they had interbred with the Chinese. Yeah. Now, I have to say that my wife, who is Japanese, found the logic here completely convincing. And I of course, endorse it wholly. although she's an architect, and she was a little suspicious of the idea that only the Chinese had ever figured out that you could orient buildings north, east, south, and west.
Right.
So I guess I would say that, kidding aside, that the book is really, really fun. But I just really had a hard time actually believing all of it.
Yeah, yeah. Or any of it.
Well, yeah.
Well put. Okay. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. So I wanted to ask you about the book explores, again, this really powerful ripple effect. And one of them is you write about that Columbus had, of course, tried to establish this overseas trade with China.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really work.
But then didn't get to China.
Yeah, it didn't get to China. A Spanish explorer named Miguel Lopez de Legazpi.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was able to do it.
Right.
And you write about how that really, in some ways, this is when the economies of the world really did begin to get intertwined.
Right. There's actually a terrific article by two professors at the University of Pacific said globalization began in 1571. Mm. And that's when Legazpi establishes a colony, a Spanish colony in Manila in the Philippines. And right away, Manila, that area has been trading with China for centuries. And they establish this colony there, and on cue, these Chinese ships show up. Mm. And this begins this trade across the Pacific that for the first time unites all of the habitable parts of the world in a single loop of commerce. And yeah. This is really the beginning of globalization.
What's so interesting about it is you talk about kind of the unintended effect, again, that's playing out in all of these stories and this ripple that happens once sweet potatoes and corn are introduced
right.
in China. And this you talk about this moment. This, in some ways, this is when China becomes China.
Right. Well, what happens is, when the reason the Europeans are trying to get to China, right, Columbus and everybody is going to – in fact, Cortez, after he conquers Mexico, one of the first things he does is try to go across the Pacific and go to China. And China, Asia, was seen as the – rightly as the wealthiest, most sophisticated part of the world. You know, and Europe was a relatively poor part of the world and wanted to get their hands on some of these luxury goods that they could make porcelain, which wasn't the Chinese could make it and the Japanese could make it, and the Europeans didn't have that technology. They could make this incredibly fine silk, and again, the Europeans didn't have that technology, and they had these wonderful things that they wanted. But the Europeans didn't make anything that the Chinese wanted, and the major industry in Europe was textiles. And in fact, there's these records of these rather pathetic records of Europeans going over to China, before Legazpi with a little ship, and in it is European textiles that they want to trade, and the main textile is wool. So they're coming over with a load of 16th century scratchy bathrobes,
are doing silk.
Yeah, and they're trying to trade it for silk, and, yeah. And the Chinese are just like totally not interested.
Right.
But this other event happens that's super important for world history and European history, which is that in 1545, the Spaniards discover this monstrous strike of silver as close to a mountain of pure silver as geology allows in southern Bolivia. It's called Potosi. And it's this vast amount of silver. And basically, most of the world at that time uses silver for their coins. And right. So they discover an entire mountain of money. And it's kind of like the Beverly Hillbillies. You know, the Spaniards find all this money, get suddenly wealthy, and go out shopping.
Yeah.
And the Chinese weren't interested in anything. Suddenly, the Spaniards show up with silver, and this is like shiploads of money. And they're terribly interested in this, of course. And that's – this pulse of silver goes across the globe. Europe becomes much, much more wealthy and really has this transformative effect, around the world. But the Chinese start initiating this trade, and then all these other things come on these ships that they're not really aware of. And one of them is the sweet potato, and the other is maize or corn.
Yeah.
And the reason this has an impact is that China doesn't really – it doesn't have really much water. It has 7% of the world's fresh water, 20% of the world's people. And their main crop, the crop that everybody wants to eat, has to be grown in swimming pools.
Yep.
It's rice. And so they don't have any really serious dry land crops. And sweet potatoes are incredibly productive if you've ever grown them. And corn is much more productive than rice or wheat. And they can grow them in these dry western hills, which before have very lightly been agricultural. And there's this big movement, just as there's a movement, go west, young man,
yeah.
across the Atlantic, across the United States, there's a parallel movement as the Chinese from the center, the Han Chinese, as they're called, push west and start deforesting these landscapes and growing maize, sweet potatoes, and then later regular potatoes.
And then, of course, they don't quite get it right, and
right.
there's massive floods.
Right.
And
exactly, because the two things happen. First, there's a huge bump in the food supply, just enormous. And the Chinese population just takes off.
Yeah.
And this is when China becomes kind of a watchword for population. It's right in this period of time, the 17th and 18th century, as the population doubles, then triples. Europe's population is also tremendously increasing at about the same time, although not as fast, thanks to the introduction of the potato into northern Europe, which pretty much ends famine in Europe. But as they move west, they haven't ever grown these kind of crops before, and they make beginner's mistakes on a massive scale. And as we know, especially you guys out here in the West know, when you cut down all the trees on mountains, this can have really unhappy effects. And so there's these cataclysmic floods all through the late 18th and 19th century that kill millions upon millions of people and so weaken the Chinese state and the Chinese economy. There's millions of people, you know, flood refugees running around, that by the 19th century, small groups of Europeans, you know, at the end of very long supply chains are able to march into China and throw their weight around. This once super sophisticated, super powerful place has just been wrecked.
By the sweet potato.
Oddly enough. Yeah, no, there's lots of misjudgments and other factors going on too. But the sweet potato and, yeah, and then in the southern part of China, corn has a big role in this.
I wanted to talk about another section in the book, which you call the most consequential exchange of all, which is the slave trade.
Right.
And here's a figure to give some perspective. Until around 1700, you say in the book, that about 90% of the people who crossed the Atlantic were African slaves.
Right. And then even after that, up to about 1820, it was almost 4-to-1 Africans to Europeans. And
that is such a misapprehension, isn't it? Because the idea that it's packed with Europeans, but they're a minority at this point.
A tremendous minority.
Tremendous minority.
And if – you know, the way I think if you're – because, you know, in part we're taking sort of a biological perspective. So let's, you know, put the biology hat on for just a moment.
Yeah.
And imagine that we're talking about this species, Homo sapiens, us. And now it's 1491, you know, before Columbus. And basically there's these Europeans, you know, and they're all in Europe.
Yeah.
And these Africans, they're all in Africa. And there's these Chinese, they're all in China. And, of course, Native Americans are all in the Americas. And then after Columbus, it's like the whole species distribution is altered. It's like we're put in a blender and you get bizarre things like Europeans being the dominant presence in places like Argentina and Australia, Africans dominating Brazil, Chinatowns all over the globe. I mean, it's weird what happens. And, you know, the way where our own species is distributed around the planet changes. But the dominating factor in all this convulsion is this monstrous movement of Africans across the Atlantic Ocean. And from that perspective, the two majority populations are Native people, even though they're declining, and Africans. And the real story, you know, this sort of biological perspective, is the meeting of Africa and Native Americans, with Europeans playing this demographically peripheral role.
It's so interesting. You talk about how there were times when they worked together, times that they didn't. You had the red Maya and the black Maya, for example.
Or they had – and in Brazil, one of the most fascinating parts for me is actually in Brazil, slavery leaked like a sieve in most parts of the Americas, and particularly in Brazil, and countless thousands escaped. And part of this was because in Brazil they were in landscapes that were similar to Central Africa and southern part of West Africa where they were from.
Right.
And the Portuguese, of course, was alien to them. It was this wet tropical forest and they didn't know how to negotiate it. Conversely, when Africans came to a place like Virginia that had winter, they were at a tremendous disadvantage and so they escaped less even though they did. And so they would go out into the interior, tens of thousands. You know, I've seen estimates from Susanna Hecht, who's a geographer at UCLA who does a lot with Brazil. She thinks about a quarter of all the slaves escaped. Wow. And we're talking about, you know, just enormous numbers poured into the forest and met up with Native people and formed these hybrid communities called quilombos. That there's about 10,000 of them that are known, and you know, really became the inhabitants of the forest. And when we're today talking about protecting the peoples of the forest and protecting the Amazon and so forth, we're talking about these hybrid cultures, which are, you know, mixtures of Africans and Native people.
You write in the book about these write about your garden in Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
How you start and you end in a garden as well. But one of the things you write about is this attempt, like many others, to, you know, eat food and grow food locally. But one of the insights from the book is that you really – none of the food that you were growing in your garden really originated locally or even really came close. But then you write about how you still have these simple joys of gardening, creating, as you put it in the book, this refuge from the world. And you write this. You said, I was making a small landscape that had the comfortable, comforting timelessness evoked by words like home. Let me ask you this finally. So yes, it's not really local, right? So what do you think is native? How do you think about home now in the context of all the stuff that you've learned?
This is a really a good question, which is the kind of thing that interviewees say when they're frantically thinking.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess it's funny. not only do we have a new garden, but as I mentioned, my wife's an architect, and so we've just actually finished designing, you know, building a house that she's designed. You know, we've been saving our pennies for 20 years. We're finally building it. And it's funny. We've got so much, you know, sweat equity, right? We've been painting and so forth that it really feels like home, even though it's brand new, because we're so invested in it. And, you know, we've created this. And the same thing, I think, is true of our garden. What really makes it home is the fact that I've puttered around in it so much. I'm the sort of person who likes to run, you know, little half-baked experiments like, what happens if we do this, you know? And, you know, as I fuss around with it, it becomes – and there's more and more of my effort and thought and so forth into it that it feels like home. And it doesn't really matter that on an emotional level that, you know, nothing in it is native to Massachusetts or native to anywhere close to Massachusetts. Right. I mean, I'm growing tomatoes, which are, you know, originally from Mexico.
Yep.
That nonetheless, they feel like my home garden.
Charles C. Mann, his book is called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Charles Mann, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.